1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon. You are very welcome to Liveline. Katie Hannan with you until three today. And we'll go straight now to David Larkin. Good afternoon, David.
Hello, Katie. How are you?
David, take us back to the early hours of last Friday morning. You are driving out on the N7, just past the Putchin Still. What happened?
That's right, Katie. About a mile past the Putchin Still, I'm driving on the main N7 out of Dublin, and I came across a deer in the middle of the road. Unfortunately, I couldn't stop. I hit the deer at speed, as you can imagine, on the N7. You're not on motorway, but you're on a national or primary road. So I was doing about 90, 95, 100 kilometres an hour. Hadn't got my full lights on because there would be traffic coming the other way. So at last minute, I spotted the deer standing in the middle of the road, and I hit him with the van.
God, that's it's a desperate fright to get, apart from anything else.
It is. A shock, major shock. I stopped about 100 yards down the road, brought the van, I swerved and just cut the corner of the van really with the deer. I stopped about 100 yards down the road by the time I brought the van to a stop. Got out, checked the van on the hard shoulder. I'd done damage to the front bumper, fog light, front left wing, but the van was driving, lucky enough I could continue my journey. Now, what I couldn't see of the deer, I don't know where they continued to jump over the entire shoulder, up the grass verge or whatever, but at the impact, I'd say more than likely he was killed or badly injured.
All right, so you didn't know whether he was still on the road or whether he was gone at that stage?
No, I didn't.
And did the deer run across the road in front of you, or was he just standing in the middle of the road?
He was just standing, yeah. He was just standing. He must have come out from the grass verge or whatever, but he was standing and I came upon him. I beeped the horn and I swerved, but unfortunately he didn't move. I thought he might move and run back towards the ditch, but he didn't move. He just froze.
And where did you hit the deer then?
His back, hind legs, that area.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, just thinking, very dangerous if he was still on the road and other traffic coming, as you say, without their full lights on.
That's right, yeah. Well, I had an incident before, I was speaking to a researcher 2 years ago, the same sort of an incident on the M11 southbound in Newtown and Kendy, and I actually rode a van off. I hit a deer, a big stag. Same issue, deer in the middle of the road, dark, late, early morning. And I rang the guard in Wicklow at the time, the guardie in Wicklow, and they told me not to attempt to get out of the van to recover the deer, because if another car was coming down, you could be killed by someone hitting you in traffic as well. So what they do normally do is to try and send someone out. If you report it, they will send someone out, a crew out, the motorway service maintenance crew, and they'll remove the deer.
And did you ring the guards on Friday, the early hours of Friday morning?
Yeah, I rang the guards Friday morning. Ratcool station would be the nearest. I was transferred to Clondalkin because Ratcool was closed. And he said it was the second incident on Friday morning, Thursday night, Friday morning, on the same stretch of road, of a deer being struck.
Wow. Wow, because I was just going to say, it seems extraordinarily bad luck on your part that you would have had two of these in the space of just, as you say, a couple of years.
Yes.
But obviously it must happen more often than we think.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to find out, is it being recorded, or the NRA or the TII have any sort of data on this? Like, I can understand, I deliver all over the sort of Leinster area. I do be up around Blessington, Ballinglass, and I can understand deer up around there on the back road. You have to be really careful. So it doesn't matter what time of the year it is. But on the main motorway or a national route, you're not expecting it to be on the road. And I'm just concerned that it's becoming a major issue, and there's going to be someone killed or a family killed or a major accident caused because of this issue.
So, well, what do you think we should be doing about it?
I think what there should be, is it being reported, first of all? Is there a need for a call? I know the deer are culled, and it's not a very pleasant thing to say, but I know the deer are culled in the Phoenix Park every year. Is there a need for a call or a data on the amount of deer that are on the road in Ireland, on the motorways? As I said, I spoke to a local politician on Friday morning, or a messenger on Facebook, for Sagart Emer Higgins, and she's from Sagart area, Slade Valley, and she's always heard the deer up around Slade Valley and Sagart, the back of Sagart, and that area, Blessington. But she's never heard them on the motorway. So.
Yeah, it's just there's such beauty. I just totally coincidentally was walking. I was walking in Wicklow myself over the weekend, and we came across a deer, a doe on her own, just as we were going through a forested area. And they're like such beautiful creatures. You know, they really stop you in your tracks when you see them in the wild like that.
Yeah.
I wonder if there, what are the numbers, or if we are getting to a stage where the wildlife experts would say that we need to think about culling. I mean, it's just it just so happens, as I say, I just had that experience of seeing that deer in the wild yesterday and being so struck by how beautiful an animal it is, and so lovely to be able to still see those kind of animals in the wild.
Okay. And as I understand, as I know, like, the issue is not with the back rows, the region, you know what I mean, up around Bleston, Donard, Glendalough round, was because you're expecting them up around there, but you don't expect them at 3 o'clock in the morning on a motorway, a main route in and out of Dublin. Without exaggeration, every night I work most nights, I deliver around the East Coast most nights, and I'm guaranteed to come across a deer every second night.
Every second night.
The Glen the Downs is notorious for us there in just past Kilmechanic. To be grazing at the side of the road there, and Newtown, Mount Kennedy, Kilcullen. It's notorious, yeah. And it's up the country roads. You're half expected, and you're not traveling at speed anyway. You're taking your time. But when you're on a motorway or on a national route, the speed limit on the motorway is 120 kilometers. So.
Oh yeah, you can absolutely see that is a huge safety issue for sure. And as you say, people who wouldn't be expecting it. Are there signs up to warn about this?
Sorry, Katie?
Are there signs warning motorists?
There is around the M11 around Newtown and Kennedy, that area, Ashford, Radnew, and there is a sign just down past on the M9 past Kilcullen, but I don't recollect any sign on the N7 past the Portuguese Dale or around that area, Sargat area, on the national route out of Dublin now.
And I wonder, I mean, would it be impossible to say, is it an issue of fencing off to stop the deer coming down onto the side?
For what experience I have, it would want to be a very high fence. You probably know yourself, Katie, they're quite athletic, they're quite muscly, and I know they have been sort of fencing off parts of the M11. But I don't know how adequate it is, or is it adequate enough to keep them from the motorway, you know, the motorway area. And I'm just I want to know is the motorway service, these contractors, are they being recorded? I know the Gardaí would ring the likes of the motorway service to get one cleared off the road, but are they recording the amount of instances that there is, that there's data going back to the NRA or the TII that they can say, right, there is an issue here, a problem here?
Yeah, that's a good question, actually. I wonder, is there data available for how often this happens? And also just advice to people in terms of, if it does happen, as you say, you were warned, you know, don't attempt to get out of the car, don't attempt to check it out.
Yeah.
But then obviously you're going to, you know, have it on your conscience as you pull away if there is an injured animal out there.
Yeah, exactly.
Dave, will you stay with us? Because we want to see if we can get any more about this. But please, if you wouldn't mind, I just want to go to another animal-related issue.
No problem, Katie.
Oh, thanks, David. Frank Brennan, good afternoon.
Hi, Katie. How are you?
Yeah, Frank, totally different in one way, but animal-related as well. You had calves went missing on you last Saturday night.
They did. Missing, believe stolen. Katie, we had, I have a dairy farm here. I live just outside Tobercurry in South Sligo. We have a 60-herd dairy farm here. I had young Friesian heifer calves, just weaned calves, just off the milk. They're born February, March this year, 11 of them. Had moved them to an area sort of towards the periphery of the farm block. Moved them this day last week, actually, to that particular plot of land that they were on. Saturday night, at some stage, early Sunday morning, they were stolen. Four of them, of the 11, were stolen from the field. Sunday morning, I was milking the cows early, and my dad said he was going to go to this particular area of the farm to feed the calves, and he came back maybe 10, 15 minutes later, and he said there was four of the calves missing. Now, I mean, initially I didn't think much of it because my initial reaction was, you know, they've broken into a neighbour's farm or...
They've wandered off
somewhere. It wouldn't be unknown to happen. So we went back around to the field where the calves were, and we spent basically the next couple of hours. We searched virtually the entire townland. All the fences in the field were intact. There was no sign that they had broken through a fence anywhere. There was no holes in the hedge or the ditch where they might have broken out. It would be very unusual for four calves on their own anyway to break out and the rest of them not to follow them, because they kind of run a leader-follower system, particularly younger animals like that. So when one goes, they'll generally all go. But searched all the neighbouring farms, talked to all our neighbours that have land bordering us. No one had seen any sign of the animals. I'm the only dairy farmer in this immediate area here, so generally if there's a black and white coloured animal in a field that it shouldn't be in, or on the road or somewhere it shouldn't be, I'll be the first one that will be contacted. So nobody had seen any trace of these animals. So we could only come to the conclusion that they, in fact, had been stolen from the field. And we contacted the Gardaí. The Gardaí came out, and they've opened an investigation on it now. I shared it on social media yesterday, and it got a huge reaction. It has been shared multiple times across various platforms. And the funny thing is, I got a phone call from a farmer who would be maybe 35, 40 minutes away from here up towards Knock or Claremorris in County Mayo, to say that on Saturday night as well, he also had four Friesian heifers stolen from his farm also.
Wow.
So, I mean, it just seems to be too much of a coincidence to be a coincidence, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, we're talking about rustling, basically, cattle rustling.
Yeah, essentially. And look, it does happen, and it's not an uncommon practice. But generally, you know, you're speaking about maybe beef cattle or lambs that will probably end up on the hook of a black market butcher somewhere within 24 or 48 hours. But would be quite unusual for dairy stock, albeit, I mean, at the moment, dairy stock are valuable animals. But they wouldn't be killed
for meat at this age, obviously. We don't really have a big veal market.
Three or four months old.
Yeah,
they're 3 to 4 months old, so they're certainly not for the meat trade at this stage. Their productive worth is as dairy animals and milk producing animals. So the fact of it is, I suppose, they obviously have a monetary loss for me. I mean, they're valuable animals.
How much would they be worth, Frank?
Well, those calves would be worth upwards of €800 a piece at the
would
moment.
Would they? 800 they each at just, what are they, four months old?
Yeah, because, and that's their current monetary worth. I mean, that's not factoring in the milk that those animals would have produced down the line, the calves that they would have. So it's almost unquantifiable the worth that they have, their future.
The loss,
worth. But,
yeah, the loss
and on top
to you.
Of that, it's the invasion as well. I mean, we live in a very quiet area. These calves in particular were in a very secluded part of the farm. Now, it does have road access, but the road that you're talking about is basically a boreen that links two secondary roads. So, I mean, nobody really... I mean, I think there's maybe four landowners that have land adjoining the road, so essentially nobody has any reason to be on that road unless they know where they're going or they're drastically lost. And, I mean, those calves were only in that particular field a week, so, you know, straight away...
You'd have to ask, though, Frank, how did people know they were there?
Well, this is the thing, Katie. I mean, the fact of it is, I mean, the reality is that there's local knowledge, or there has to be local knowledge involved here. I mean, no cattle rustling gang came from 100 miles away and drove down a boreen and outside Tubbercurry and happened upon dairy calves by chance and happened to see, you know, I mean, that's just not the way the world works.
Yeah, of course, we're not just to be clear, and I know you wouldn't, Frank, you're not casting any aspersions on any of your neighbours.
Absolutely not. No, and in fairness, I have to say, like, all of my neighbours have been extraordinarily good over the last 24 hours since I first put it out that they were missing and presumed stolen. And I've had neighbours out searching as well, their own land, and you know, of other farmers.
Yeah, it's such a sickener, though, isn't it? You know, because I know you take such pride in your calves, and you know they're hard reared, and you know it's
Completely, Katie. I mean, it's well documented at this stage that the return for a farmer's work, the hourly rate of pay, if you were to break it down, we work from the black of the morning to the black of the night, and you know, we the calves in particular, you're nurturing them from birth, you're ensuring that they avoid the normal pitfalls that calves are susceptible to, scours and pneumonia and all the other various innumerable diseases that they can suffer from, and you bring them on to a stage where you get them off their milk and they're grazing grass and they're feeding meal. I mean, that's the other thing. I mean, these calves were essentially hand-reared, hand-fed. They were getting meal once a day every morning. They'd see you coming to the gate of the fields. They'd come sprinting up the field the minute they saw you at the gate or if you called them, and, you know, they knew what feeding time was, so for four of them to indiscriminately stray away and not come back. And
sounds very unlikely. And the other odd thing, though, is I suppose it might be down to what sort of transport or what sort of a trailer they might have had. But you wonder, if they took four, why did they leave the other seven?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's one of the imponderables, I suppose. But I guess, I mean, those calves had an outlet before they were stolen. I mean, normally the way these things work is that there's no reason to steal a calf unless there's an outlet for them.
So they're stolen to order. Sorry, Frank, that's what you're saying.
Well, they're stolen to order. And, I mean, from a traceability point of view, obviously those calves are tagged and they're registered to my herd number. They can't go into another farmer's herd unless I move them into his herd on through the Department of Agriculture Ag Food System or whatever. The other thing about it as well is, and I would stress this, those calves are DNA profiled. Now, that's a relatively new development between ICBF and the Department of Agriculture, where there is a database of DNA information on livestock now being kept by ICBF. It's geared really towards the agri-environmental focus in agriculture at the moment and genomics and from a security point of view as well. So if those calves remain in the jurisdiction, that DNA profile will show up at some stage. Now, it may come too late for those animals to be ever of any use to me again, but it might happen in 5 or 6 or 10 years' time if they ever go to a meat factory or if they're, if they're genomic tested or if there's a farmer entering into an agri-environmental scheme.
If they go over the border, Frank, if they're taken over the border, does that flag come up?
Well, in short, no. If they're taken over the border, I mean, I can pretty much wave my hat at them. Because, and again, this is, you know...
And tell me, did the guards give you any idea of what they think has happened here or whether they think it might be a cross-border gang or whether they've come across other cases?
No, they haven't indicated anything in that respect with regards to an over or cross-the-border gang. Anecdotally, the case of the farmer in, you know, that's 3/4 of an hour up the road from me here, that had the same number of animals, the same breed of animals, on the same night, stolen, again, dairy stock, which, again, is quite unusual in cases of cattle rustling. Mm-hmm. Only, I think, maybe a month or two ago, there was a case in Clochjordan in Tipperary where a farmer had 7 dairy heifers stolen. Now, those were returned after, I think, there was a concerted campaign and focus in that case, and basically those animals became too hot to handle and they were thrown back into a farmer's yard a couple of weeks later and returned.
So are you hoping, Frank, hoping that if the word gets out there now and we're telling people now to keep an eye out?
I am, of course, yeah. I'm realistic as well. I know it's a long shot at this stage, but I am hopeful that as I said, there's an outlet for those calves. Unless there's a destination for those calves to arrive at, then there's no reason to steal them. So somebody somewhere knows something. Okay. Somebody, you know, in the relative locality knows something, because, as I said, those calves were in an area where, you know, unless there was,
unless there was knowledge kind of there, they wouldn't have
been,
they wouldn't
have been taken. A lot of reconnaissance taking place, you know, that you're not going to know they're there.
Okay.
And
okay.
Look, I'd appeal to anyone that, you know, if they maybe saw or heard anything on late Saturday night, early Sunday morning, because again, look, in this area, a cattle truck or a trailer on the road, it's not a particularly unusual phenomenon, but maybe if you see one at 2 or 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, it's a different story.
Yeah.
So, you know, anything that might jog anyone's memory or, you know, that raises any kind of suspicion, I know there's a lot of premises around.
And it's the guards in Tobercory that's looking into it, Frank, is it?
Yeah, so it's the guards in Tobercory that are investigating it at the moment.
Okay.
So
okay.
They're following it up and the investigation is ongoing.
Okay. Okay, Frank, the very best of luck. If we hear anything at all, we will, of course, pass it on to you and let you know. We might have you back on again. But best of luck with that now. And I want to go back to the deer story. We were talking to David, and I think we still might have David on the line there, about his rather traumatic incident where he hit a deer on the Naas Road on Friday morning. Tom Murray, good afternoon to you.
How are you? How's things?
I'm good. The deer.
The deer, well, that deer that was on Friday morning, that deer was actually dead on the Naas Road. It was actually just, he hit it there around the turn off for Dasher Logistics there.
How do you know
It was dull. I actually drive out of Dasher Logistics, so I actually came down the slip road and I seen the deer dead in the road. And she was dead. I got out to check, she was dead.
All right. And what time was that?
I would have been coming now there around 20 past 6 in the morning. But she was dead on the road, on the side of the road, like, you know. She was just on the hedge holder.
And would you have come across this ever before?
I'd say in the past 2 weeks I'd seen about 5 dead deer on the Naas Road.
In the past how many weeks?
In the past two and a half weeks.
5 deer in the past 2.5 weeks on around the same part of the Naas Road?
It would have been within a distance, say, between Putchin Still and probably the far side of Naas, just the far side of Naas there.
Okay, let me just ask David, exactly where do you think that deer would have gone down?
Yeah, that's exactly sounds right, where the deer went down. Yeah, definitely.
Right.
Yeah, and I have seen deer myself in the last couple of weeks down that road, because I go down that road every morning around the same time, around 3:30.
Right.
And it was one in Kilcullen, past Kilcullen the other morning as well. It was bagged, it was baby stag at the side of the road as well, on the hard shoulder.
Right. So, I'm astonished, actually. I just had no idea that this thing was happening so often. Tom, you said 5 deer in the last 2 or 3 weeks.
Yes, I've seen dead on the Naas Road. One was a baby fawn that actually, I'd say she must have got a belt of a lorry or something, because the deer was just cut in half, like, you know.
Oh, God, okay. I hope nobody was trying to eat their lunch at that moment. and of course, we know that people are going at a fair clip there. You know, you're heading out onto the N7, the M7.
Well, they will be doing 100 to 120 on it, like, you know. It's a 100K zone, so they will be doing the 100K
as far as Naas, and then right.
And have you ever had any near misses yourself, Tom?
On the back road coming down from, there's a little back road that comes down from the Blue Door in Strathen.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when the rut starts, you'll get stray stags running across the road there, and I've had a few very close ones there myself, like, you know.
Right.
Where I've had it on dash cam footage as well, like, where they'd run across the road in front of you, they'd be running down the road, like, in front of you, you know.
Yeah, it's just it's so dangerous, really, isn't it? Like, you really, really need to be very, very careful when you're in that territory.
Yeah, well, I know at the moment I was talking to David Dunn, he's out with the Wild Deer Association there, and they're actually, you know, if you take photographs and send it into them, they're trying to work to get the council to put up signs all over, you know, where there is deer, to make people aware that a deer could be liable to run out in front of you at any minute, you know.
Yeah, because I wonder, really, is there an awareness there? Because I certainly wouldn't have been aware that it was that regular an occurrence, for sure.
Especially when it comes around the rutting season, when the stags are rutting, like, you know, like, kind of, they stray off into all different areas. And that's when you'd see them a lot more. But at the moment, it's just a lot of baby fawns around at the moment. And it's not nice when you see a baby fawn dead on the road, like, you know.
Oh, God, no. Or not nice to see any animal, wild animal dead on the road like that. Tom, many thanks for that.
No problem.
I want to bring in Alan now. Alan, good afternoon to you.
Hey, good afternoon.
you hit a deer, was it yesterday?
Yesterday, yeah.
What happened?
We're coming from Dublin down to West Cork, down to my parents for a week's holidays. And about 2:30 in the afternoon, maybe a little afterwards, we were outside Naas on the M7 between Naas and the M9 turnoff. And a deer came across, it came from the right-hand side. So it came across three lanes of traffic that were going inbound. And then across two lanes into our path. And thankfully, there was no car on the lane inside me. So I was able to take some evasive action and move into that lane. But as I did so, it struck its head off the front bumper and spun it back across the motorway into the central median.
Gosh.
So, poor thing was gone. And we pulled up the car then on the hard shoulder. So a bit of damage on the front bumper, just some cracks and stuff, but nothing too substantial, thankfully, there. But we were lucky that there was nobody on the lane inside us, because if I wasn't able to take that evasive action, we'd have gone straight into the side of it, and that would have been a whole other story.
It absolutely would. And you say you had your kids in the car with you?
Yep. We had two kids and the two of ourselves then as well. So thankfully, they didn't seem to see much of what had happened. They were aware of what had happened, but they didn't really see anything much. So there was no upset there, at least, thankfully.
God, you must have, like, that's the kind of thing that comes back, many hours later to you when you think it through and think what might have happened.
Yeah, it's the last thing I expected on the motorway. You know, across there, it's six lanes each direction. And I think the speed limit along there is 120, but we were doing 100 because we had the tent on the roof and everything. So at least.
And this was in the middle of the afternoon, just to be clear.
About 2:30 in the afternoon, yeah, maybe a little after 2:30 in the afternoon.
God, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, Helen, thank you for that. That is hair-raising. The amount of damage that could have been done on any of those traffic lanes that deer came across that road.
Oh, absolutely. It came across five lanes of traffic before our bumper. But we drove on then afterwards, and there's another deer carcass on the side of the road there as well, about maybe another kilometre along. So it seems to be very common along there.
Okay, well, let's find out if we can, if it is, how common it is. Alan, thank you for that. I want to bring in Ger O'Brien. Ger, good afternoon.
Hi, Katie, how are you?
Yeah, you're with the Wild Deer Association. You were mentioned there a moment ago.
Yeah, I'm chairman of the Wild Deer Association. We deal with road collisions quite regularly. This time of the year, it's just two times of the year. We say during the rut in October, when the stags are running around, you get a lot of accidents. And this time of the year, then what's happening is the females have gone off on their own. You said you met one yesterday on her own.
Yeah.
She would have had a calf hidden somewhere nearby. So what they do is they go away on their own to have their young. And last year's young then is hunted off to fend for himself. And they're the ones that are getting hit on the road. They have no traffic sense, whereas the older female would have some level of traffic sense, but the younger ones wouldn't have. And we get called out to accidents quite regularly. We have a humane dispatch unit that if people report accidents to us, we'll go with a recovery dog, find the deer, and if it needs to be dispatched, then we'll do that.
David, who was our first caller on this, was saying, he's had two near misses now, or not near misses. He hit the deer in both times, but thankfully no injuries to himself. He was saying that it's time to, why aren't we culling these deers?
Oh, yeah, we do a fair amount of culling as well. That a lot of our members would be deer stalkers. They're not all deer stalkers. A lot of them would be interested in deer. We're interested in the welfare of deer, but the population of deer has increased a hell of a lot over the past few years. And
why is that?
A lot of the recreational hunters will never shoot a female because they're just too squeamish about that, And the female population has been let increase over the years. And it's gone to the stage now where drastic action needs to be taken, really. And last year, because of the pandemic, most hunters weren't allowed travel because you couldn't go outside your 5K. So the national cull, there's about 4,000 deer culled per year. And that cull wasn't reached at all last year, half of that. So
who sets that figure? Who decides how many deer need to go?
Yeah, it's up to the landowner, and whoever owns the land that they are on can decide. Cuilte, which is a forestry group, they will decide themselves how many deer need to be called out of each area. And there's no regulation on the amount. You can't force people to call, and you can't force people to not call either, you know. That.
And when we say call, we're shooting, we're talking about shooting.
Yeah, shooting.
And is there a way to shoot them that's considered more humane? Or?
Oh, yeah. We do training courses all the time now. Our next training course is on the 18th of July. We train people, we have a range shoot, how to train people how to shoot safely. And then we have a carcass handling demonstration where we explain to people how to handle an animal once it's shot, how to bleed it, how to gut it, and how to identify disease like TB and stuff like that. So we're ongoing training all the time. And then what we do then with our surplus venison then to pay back, we give to the homeless there. In last Saturday night in Dublin there, just off from the spire there, we cooked 430 burgers for the homeless.
Venison burgers,
yeah, handed them out free. And we'll be there again now next Saturday night. If anyone wants a free burger, we'll be there from 6:30 to 9. And say we get about 430 last week.
Hey, Katie, can I just interject there? Is that
David?
It is indeed, yeah. David. Jerry. Jerry, regarding this, Jerry, have you noticed in the last few years, they seem to be further down towards the main areas, urban areas, like down around the motorways. Like, I'd live around Blessington, Vaultonglass, Donard, all that area, and you're guaranteed to see them. That's not an issue. But it just seems to be more and more on the motorways now, in the main urban areas that they are. The deer is, the population's increased, whether they're being pushed out from sort of deer in territory or whatever, I don't know. You know more about that.
The problem is there, you see, it's not a terribly safe area to cull. Now, we have specialists, people that can call in an urban area, in a built-up area, but that you're only talking about a handful of people that you'd be that to be capable of doing that. So that,
yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, you know, the idea of having anybody out with a gun in an area where there is
a lot of
is built up in any way would be a little bit terrifying.
Yeah, it is, of course. Yeah, it is. There's only a specialist you can send in there to do that. So that's where you haven't them problems. You can send. Well, the average person may be into the hills in Wicklow, maybe, and you know, they're not as likely to do harm. But into the urban areas, that's where we have a problem. Now, motorways should be fenced. Like, we're involved. We do a survey for TII, that'd be Transport Infrastructure Ireland. We do surveys for them, and we recommend mitigation then, whether it needs to be fencing or various things. There's various ways of preventing deer from you can't ever stop them completely, but there is things you can do to prevent them from going onto the roadways.
Okay. Will you stay there, Jerry? And Dave, stay with us, David. Yeah. We'll have to take a break. 51551 is our text line, but we'll stick with this after these.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
And we were talking there before the break with Ger O'Brien, who is from the Wild Deer Association of Ireland. Ger, I was wondering, because I mentioned it earlier, there was a clip doing the rounds over the weekend. I think it's actually an old video of Phil Spencer, who is, of course, the presenter of Location, Location, Location. And he had killed a deer, his first kill of a deer. And he was described, he was absolutely chuffed, and he was lifting up the deer in his arms and saying how... basically how delighted he was that it had been his lifetime ambition to kill a deer and that he was going to maybe have a taste of it later. And a lot of animal rights people were very, very upset by the tone of that video and just the whole idea of it, basically, that this would be your lifetime ambition. Did you get much of that, Ger, in terms of, you know, people's interaction with yourselves?
Ah, you will, of course, yeah. I mean, people don't want to see anything killed, chickens, lambs, whatever. Any meat you eat has been killed by somebody somewhere. But no, we don't glorify hunting deer.
Sorry, Gerard, to cut across you, I'm just told that we actually have a clip so people will know what we're talking about. Just give us 1 second, we'll just play it. This is Phil Spencer.
Beside us, it was a pretty tricky shot and walked almost under us. It kept very still. and managed to get a cheeky shot on a slightly difficult angle. Didn't actually think that I'd hit it because it didn't sound like I'd hit it.
It was when it surprised you that you
did. It clattered off and I thought I've missed my chance. Well, I am absolutely chuffed to bits. It's been my ambition to shoot a deer for a very, very long time. Thanks, buddy. But I will remember you
for
as long as I shall live. Hopefully, I might get to taste him as well.
Why don't you take it home with you?
Fantastic.
Yeah, that was Phil Spencer there, the TV presenter. Ger, you can imagine that some people would find that very distasteful.
Sure, of course. I do as well. You know, I mean, he's just trying to dramatise the whole thing. I mean, the problem with deer in Ireland is they have no natural predator, and the only way of controlling them is to shoot them. There is no other way. Anything talking about contraception and stuff like that is just nonsense. It's a waste of time. There is no other method of controlling deer, only to shoot them. And what we train people to do is to do it humanely, do it properly, and shoot the right animal. And if it's done properly, the deer has no idea what's after happening, and you don't disturb the other deer around them. You shoot the one that needs to be shot, and it's processed properly then and handled properly. It's a food product then at that stage.
And if at this time of year, obviously we were talking about the fawn being around and that the does are, you know, have fawn with them.
Mm-hmm.
Are you allowed to shoot female deer at this time of year?
All are. No. You can't shoot females until the 1st of November. From the 1st of November, then the fawn is weaned at that stage then and is independent and can survive on its own. So you can shoot from the 1st of November then until the end of February. And
you can shoot male, you can use stags any time of year, can you? Or?
No, you shoot the stags then, the stag season or stag or buck, depending on which it is, can start in 1st of September until the end of December.
Right.
So then January, February is female only then. And it's a good time of the year in the springtime to, the vegetation has died down. You can see your animal a lot clearer and they spend more time out on the grassland. And as I said earlier, the population has increased. And the problem here is that there's not enough being shot, really, in areas now. I'm not saying everywhere, but in areas, definitely not enough. Yeah.
But people do get a thrill out of shooting these animals. I mean, that's part of it, isn't it?
Actually, I don't know that they get a thrill out. They get a thrill out of the hunt, to actually be out there in nature and observe the animals. We most of our hunting is done from high seats. So you're in a high seat up over the ground where you have a safe shot down and you observe your animals. You pick out the animals that are, we say 5 or 6 deer in a field. What you do is you look for one that may be an older animal, because if it gets too old, it has no natural predator, it's going to die of hunger because they lose their teeth and everything else. And that's what you're looking for. You're looking for an animal that's either injured, lame, old, and you call the right animal is what you want to call, really, you know. And that's what we try to train people to do. Not just shoot the first deer you see, or not to shoot the biggest one you see.
Right. Okay, Ger, will you stay there? Because I've got Jacqueline on another line. Jacqueline, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Katie.
That sounds very responsible now, what Ger was saying there, that, you know, what people are trained to do, to look at the older deer, the ones that may not have much longer in them anyway. Yes, where do you stand on this?
Yeah, I can certainly understand his attitude, his opinion in that regard. The only thing that I have question is the fact that sometimes instead of taking measures to prevent deer coming onto a motorway, you know, that there isn't fencing put up by the council or the Road Safety Authority. Like, there are lots of measures taken by the Road Safety Authority, you know, to prevent accidents. And it's shocking to think that your callers there have said that so many deer have gone out onto public roads and, you know, possibly caused a lot of accidents.
Yeah, but I think, to be fair to Ger, he said that they do advise the council about where fencing may be required. And, you know, that's part of what they do.
That's part of what they do. But then where's the responsibility from the county council, you know, that they don't go ahead and put those measures in place and that there's adequate fencing to prevent that? like, I travel a lot to work, and I see, you know, during the course of the travel, lots of dead animals on the road, smaller animals. I've never encountered a deer, thank goodness, or horses or cattle. But it's very unpleasant to see small animals even lying dead on the road, dogs and cats and rabbits and hedgehogs and everything. And it must be terrifying to see a larger animal and little fawns. You know, it's not nice. It's very unpleasant.
Would you
think that the council would allow that to go on for a period of time without intervening quickly and stopping those deers? Like, one of your callers said that there were so many deers had been reported seen on a stretch of road over a period of 2.5 weeks.
Yeah.
You know, 2.5 weeks is a length of time that somebody could not go out and put up a proper fence or herd deer back out of the way of traffic. You know, when you consider lots of families on holidays, you know, it's terrifying to think that can happen in a second and someone could end up dead and deers can end up dead. And another question I would like to ask also is, from an animal welfare point of view, when that does happen, is there a vet called out promptly to attend to the animal to lessen an animal's suffering when that happens on the roadway?
I think, Gerry, you got called in many of these cases.
Yeah, we got called. We urge the public, if you ever hit a deer, and even if it's only slightly clipped, call us, let us know. We have trained tracking dogs, and we have a humane dispatch unit, and we have members in every county, so we have trained up members in most areas, and we'll go out as soon as we get the call. We'll go out, go in with a dog, find the dog, will track the deer into cover, find the deer, and if the deer is only slightly injured, then you leave them alone. And if the deer is injured enough that he needs veterinary treatment, most cases that deer has to be put down, because the drugs you need to treat the deer may not be licensed to enter the human food chain. So if that deer is treated by a vet and it ends up in the food chain later on, a shot a year later on or whatever else, the drugs wouldn't be licensed to enter the food chain. So the most humane thing to do then is put that deer down. If it's seriously injured, put them down. And we do that. Like, if people have contacted us, WDAI.ie, if they contact us on that website, you'll get our phone numbers then off of that. And we'll, it's too late to be at that stage to be doing anything, but we'd prefer the deer was never hit in the first place. But if it goes to that stage, then
you're the one to call, yeah.
That we're the ones to call, yeah.
Okay. Margaret Franklin, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie. Well, I just wanted to let you know that the Canadians have come up with a solution to this problem of wildlife on the highways. So I was on a holiday 2 years ago. I was visiting my son, who lives in Edmonton, and we went for a short break up to the Rocky Mountains, and we were in the Banff National Park, and they have fencing in place to begin with, but they also provide bridges over the motorways, or whatever they call them over there, highways, so that the wildlife can get across. Because, you see, the highways are encroaching on their habitat. So it's not fair just to fence them off and cut them off from another part of their habitat. So they've provided these safe passageways over the motorways. And they don't look like normal bridges because they have greenery on them. You know, they've got shrubs and things growing on either side. So the wildlife think they're still in the wild. They don't really see the motorway. They might hear the noise. But I think I'm just wondering, would that be a possible solution in Ireland?
I don't know, would we call the Long Mile Road natural habitat for deer?
I know, it is different. It's a natural park. But I was thinking of places like the Glen of the Downs. I don't know if that's a problem. Do deer come down there?
Oh, no, there's definitely a lot of deer on the roads in Wicklow.
That sort of a location might be feasible, you know? So I just thought I'd throw it out there and see what people think.
Yeah, Ger.
That's a brilliant idea, and it is great. And actually, I used to work for a company where I'd done the surveys for these motorways, and I used to recommend mitigation for deer and badgers and everything. We put tunnels under all the motorways for badgers and foxes and squirrels and pine martens and all those animals. They haven't yet put any in for deer. I was hoping they would when I was doing the surveys.
Sorry, Gerry, are you saying here in Ireland we have tunnels for badgers to go under the motorways?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And anywhere, I used to do the surveys for this. You'd survey where a badger set is before the motorway is built, and you find where he's living and where he's feeding, and if the motorway is crossing through his forage area, what you do is you put in a tunnel where the badger is naturally crossing anyway, and you fence 300 metres either side of that tunnel so he's not likely to go by the side of it. And they use it regularly. Yeah, it is quite a common thing.
There's another thing you learn every day. I did not know that. But you're saying you wouldn't have a tunnel for a deer, though, would you? That would have to be a bridge, would it?
No, I recommended tunnels for deer one time, and they wouldn't put them in because they said sheep could go through them and cattle could go through them, and the landowners mightn't want that. But it is possible and it should be done probably. And as regards the fencing, we're working on a project at the moment now at J.W. Leakes there in Leash. A lot of deer getting hit on the road there now, and especially in the last month, a lot of deer get hit. And we've got signs put up, you know, the big electronic signs warning people of deer crossing at the moment. But the Transport Infrastructure Ireland are going to fence that, or they're in the process of doing it anyway, according to our recommendations. We done the survey for them and for Leash County Council, and it's been handed over to the road network then. And
okay.
So they will fence that, but...
Okay, well, that's good. That's good to know that one part of the country is getting looked after. But I think we may come back to this again, because that is obviously a big issue at this time of year, if that many animals are getting injured on the roads. And
there's another thing they can do then. Sorry for coming across you, Casey. There's another thing they can do there where if fencing isn't feasible. What you have at the edge of the road, instead of having a very straight line of trees, deer don't like a straight line. If they come out on a straight line, they tend to just dash out. They tend to run because they don't like that. But if you have a staggered line of shrubs and trees and bushes, that they can stand behind one. So if a deer crosses in front of you, if he gets in behind one bush at all, he's happy. He's not likely to dart back into traffic.
Okay.
And if it's in the dusk and he crosses in front of you, when the light of your car is on the deer, his shadow meets the hedgerow the same time as he meets the hedgerow. And it's his own shadow that he jumps back from, because he thinks it's a predator coming for him. And he jumps away from the shadow and runs back into traffic. That's what can happen. So if you have a staggered row of trees on the edge of the road verge, you'll cut down on the amount of accidents.
Okay, Ger, I'm putting you in charge of national deer minding.
Sorry, Katie, could I cut across just for one second, please?
Okay, briefly. That's Jacqueline.
It's just the level of animal cruelty. People, I think, get desensitised considering factory farming with chickens and pigs, etc. And I think people sometimes then disregard, you know, wildlife as well, and the hazards that they have to encounter on a daily basis. And it's good that there are, you know, people out there that, you know, sort of look after those. But it's just that people do become desensitised to the level of animal cruelty going on in the world today. And people need to, you know, open their eyes and realise that.
Okay, Jacqueline, many thanks for that. Ger,
thank you.
Thanks for calling in with that. And Margaret, many thanks for that bright idea.
Thank
from
you,
Canada. We'll take a break. 51551.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Now, there's a lot of focus on the housing market at the moment. We're reading in the newspapers this morning that prices are rising by 1,500 a week. Or a month, I should say, or 100 euro a day in one of the headlines this morning. And of course, a huge part of this is a big problem with supply. The supply just isn't there, particularly of second-hand houses. And once again, the focus has hit on older people who maybe have reared their families and now find themselves rattling around big houses that they don't need. And they're being asked to maybe think about moving on. Leo, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. I just made a few notes on this. Like, we got married in 73, moved to Talla, which was the cheapest house in Dublin at the time. 20 years later, we moved to a four-bed because we had five children. We built on an extension later on because my mother-in-law came to live with us. Now there's only the two of us. All our children are housed and moved away. But, like, we built up a community here in Talla. And when we were younger, we wanted things in Talla, the facilities. We joined different groups, and we got the Gael School as an example, right? Now, we're not just living in a house, we're living in a community. Now, what has the government done to, say, relocate me? There's no two-bed houses in Talla, say, where I could downsize to. Or have they looked at the cost of downsizing? My son moved recently, and he was reckoning it would cost about 10,000 between fees and all the rest of it. The furniture you have in the house is probably too big if you're going to downsize, so you've got to change the furniture. But, like, this is stuff that we've worked for all our lives, and now they're trying to put a guilt trip on us. Now, as far as I'm concerned, the government have some cheek. I mean, we paid for creches and we paid for our gyms and all the rest of it. They already have these subsidised two bars and all the rest of it. And they're trying to tell old people now, like ourselves, oh, look, you know, you shouldn't be really in a two-bed house. These people, a lot of the TDs are landlords. Like, where are they, what are they doing about it? And they have places in the country, and then they have places in Dublin then, because they use the dial and all the rest of it. So what I feel is that, yes, if there was facilities made to move as old people, say, now, myself and my wife live together, so that's grand. But if it was on my own, I might think about it. But there's nowhere. I don't want to move out to, say, Cabin Teely, for example. I don't know where I'm going to be out in
Cabin Teely. Not that there's anything wrong with Cabin Teely, Liam.
No, no, no. But I'm just saying, you know, I don't want to move to another location, greater as it all may be. Because, therefore, I'm leaving all my friends. I've got to start making friends at 72 years of age. Like, they really haven't thought about this. If they wanted me to move, or encourage people to move, they would have been building facilities in our area so that I can still go to my local parish church, I can go to the gym, I can go to do the things that I'm involved in here. But they haven't done that. But then, now that all of a sudden they're thinking, after all these years of messing around with the housing market, oh, let's throw the blame onto someone else.
So well, I think, Leo, and you might remember this yourself, the last time I heard the talk about encouraging or incentivising older people to downsize was 4 years ago. I think it was the then Housing Minister, Owen Murphy, who's, of course, gone out of politics now, but he was putting forward that idea 4 years ago. And if I remember correctly, they retreated from that notion fairly quickly because I think they got
the grey vote again moved.
Exactly, yeah. There was a definite backlash against that idea, but floated again last week in relation to where we're at now. I suppose things have changed to some degree over those 4 years, though, Leo, because I think there is a big appreciation now that there is, like, basically anyone born after the 1980s or afterwards are really, really locked out of home ownership.
Oh, Katie, well, our house, our first house cost 4,750. We sold it for 17. We bought for 24. Our house now is probably worth 450,000. It's ridiculous. It's just not worth that. But that's the only thing I have to leave my family. Now, if I was to move, what's it going to cost me to get a two-bedroom house? Let's say I moved into town. I mean, it nearly costs that just to move. The houses in town are getting up to 500 and more. There's a house in the market the other day in Rap Mines that went starts at 650. It's now 1.2 million. So, like, you know, what they're saying is not practical. No one has actually looked into it and done the research to say, well, is this possible for A, to move? And what would it cost someone to move? You know, it's one of these ideas they come up with. I mean, they've had the housing market in a mess for the last, I don't know, many governments now, and they haven't done anything about it. But yet now, here we are, the vulture funds are having great fun. I mean, if you go to Cherrywood, I think it is, they're building the apartments there left, right and centre, but they're all rent to buy. So the ordinary, like, I'm lucky that my children have it. My grandchildren are going to be in a right problem. That's what I say, because the houses are not there. They're not building houses. You know,
that is the problem. There just is an ongoing supply issue that's not going to be sorted anytime soon.
I was an electrician in a previous life, and the tradesmen during the pandemic, they didn't train them. They could have kept them some on and trained them. Now they're saying they don't have tradesmen. I mean, they can't seem to look further than their end of their nose. They can't seem to plan that this is going to happen down the line. That, okay, once afterwards. We're a growing population, but the housing market hasn't grown. I mean, I personally lived in Bristol Street in the flats. I went from a tenement house to flats, so I know what they're like. And it's nothing like living in your own garden, just able to sit out in your own garden and do this and things. But, like, if I thought that, you know, the house was going to someone, I wouldn't mind going back to an apartment, I think. But I'd want an apartment with a bit more facilities in it. But, like, I don't want it in town. I want it in Talla. There's nothing being built. The houses that are being built in Talla are these shoebox things that you get. You know, the planning hasn't really kept up with the demand. If you go on the continent, people live in apartments. But they're big apartments. They're livable. The ones we have are shoeboxes that people are thrown into, and then you end up with one family or one child, then you end up with two. The two houses are too big and you have to move then at that stage.
You know? And of course we know that, well, in an effort, to be fair to them, to try and stimulate the market and have more apartments built, the standards of those apartments were actually pulled back. They were lowered over the last number of years. So we're getting more of the smaller apartments.
And if you look at recently, they were saying that they're now allowing them to reduce the number of parking facilities they provide, parking spaces in an apartment block. And as someone said recently, I mean, if you buy an apartment, where are you going to park? You're going to park on your neighbour's road because they're going to club. So they happen, it's all bring down the cost to the builder, but the cost is still going up to the client, to the families at the end of the day.
Would you ever think of, the rent a room scheme where you can rent and you can have X amount of income from renting a room?
My daughter did it, and we thought about it because we thought one or two of our grandchildren might be going to university or college up here. But she wants to go and live in the college life. Now, it didn't happen because last year, the way things were, she never got to college. She was online. But that's why we've been holding back. But yes, I would think about it,
Yeah, because, I mean, do you feel now, because your family are reared, obviously, now, and you have your four-bed house, you said you were in now with your extension. Do you feel it's too big for yourself and your wife now?
No, because our family stay over and off. We'd have the grandkids staying over. But it is, yes, it, from a practical point of view, if I was buying this house today, I certainly wouldn't be looking at a four-bed. We're going to have to buy a house tomorrow for some reason. You wouldn't be buying a four-bed.
No.
You don't need it.
No.
And it's an old house. It was built in 64, so we have a huge garden. You wouldn't get this house in a modern version of it, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they probably have two or three houses on the same side. I wouldn't be looking at a four bed. I mean, definitely that's what we do. It's just too big. But at the same size,
you were saying that at the start there that you're being guilt tripped into do you feel a bit anyway guilty at all to have that?
No, because I'm saying if someone was, if the people who were telling me this were making sacrifices, but I don't see them making any of these sacrifices, what they were saying is they want you to make the sacrifice. I mean, we worked and paid our taxes to get to where we are today. No one handed to us. And I mean, I'm not saying the younger people are not working. That's not what I'm saying, because, there's some of them are working their butts off and they're never going to end up in a house. But the people who are telling us this have huge salaries and then they go out on huge pensions. Why don't you transfer some of this money back into the housing and try and do something with the housing? I mean, Peter McFerry Trust and people like them, they're building bloody houses. The council's built houses for years. And they were successful. Now, the problem with that was, I think maintenance was a huge problem, because if I break a window, I've got to pay for it. But if someone else breaks a window in the council house, I think they can get it done. I'm not sure about that. But the maintenance costs of running the house. But if you put people into these houses and they look after the maintenance, that would bring down the cost. My daughter recently was paying more. I think she was paying something like $1,200 a month in rent. Yet, we were able to get a mortgage for her for $560. So it was half the repayments for a mortgage. It didn't make sense.
Oh, we hear that,
lucky enough that would our help to get the mortgage, the down payment. So there's something wrong in the market, and it's not the old people who caused it.
Yeah, that's for sure. For sure, we hear that over and over again, that people are paying rents that are way and above and beyond what they would be paying if they were able to get the mortgage. But they can't get the mortgage, of course. Yeah.
You can't save and pay that sort of rent. It's not physically possible. They're not earning that sort of money. And those that are earning it have already bought, houses, bigger houses and type. They're different. But the ordinary guy, man, on average wage, is never going to be able to afford a house in Dublin at the way it's going at the moment. And now it's spreading to all the bigger cities.
And Leo, the bottom line with you anyway is you're not budging.
Not at the moment. Not unless you come up with some fantastic offer,
Okay. Leo, thanks. Thanks
much
a million
indeed.
For that.
Okay, bye-bye.
Take care. 1850-715-815. We'll take a break.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815. Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
Anne, good afternoon to you.
Hi, Katie, how are you? So my story goes basically that recently I was a victim of online fraud, or invoice fraud, as we call it, where I was paying installments to a company via online bank transfer. This is done via email instructions as normal.
Go back, and I say we're not going to name the company now because it may be a subject of some legal action down the line. So we're not saying what you were, what the this company was, but you were paying for a service and you were paying them in installments online.
Exactly, online, yeah.
And at some stage you got instructions to change the address that you were sending the money to.
Yeah, so basically I received an email from the user person I was in contact with telling me the bank account details had changed and to lodge the money into a different account. So I and at this stage I confirmed this change by email as that was how I was normally communicating.
You know what, Anne? Sorry to cut across you, Anne, but you know that line is just not holding up well. I think we might just take a very quick ad break and try and get you back on a better line, just so we can hear what you're saying.
Okay.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Now I hope we have Anne back with us. Good afternoon again, Anne.
Hi, Katie. Okay, sorry about that.
That's much better, yes.
Okay.
So perfect. Just to remind people, you were paying a company for a service online. And you were being invoiced online for this service.
Yeah, just by email and bank transfer to the company for services or a product actually that they supplied. In the middle of the communication then... I was told by the same person I've been dealing with to lodge the money to a different account.
So you got an email asking you to...
I got an email from the same person, same guy I was talking to. And I confirmed this by email, because that's how we were communicating. And then it was sometime later when the next installment was due, they sent details again, along with the bank account details, statement of final balance, which was all correct. And it was only when I started to receive phone calls from the company asking me why the payments weren't made that alerted me to what had happened.
Okay, now we're talking about a lot of money here, Anne.
We are, yeah. Substantial amount, yes.
Do you want to say how much?
It was over 20,000 in total with the installments. So, I mean, at that stage, the money, there was like most service had been provided and paid for. So it was just literally in the middle of all this that what happened basically was... we had discovered that there were numerous emails sent to me by the company requesting payments, which I never received. And then emails I'd sent to them were also blocked. So it turned out the company's email account was hacked, and the hacker stepped in with the exact same email address and details required for payments. So, and this has been since confirmed on record with the guards that, in fact, the company were hacked. So...
So you got the product from the company, but now the company were saying that they don't have your money.
Exactly, and obviously I got in touch with the banks involved, including my own bank account, and my own bank, with the no results information where the money went to, so I've been chasing and have been, the money has never been recouped, much to my tireless efforts. And I just feel, I suppose, as well, that the banks need to be more accountable in these incidents where, in this day and age, money can be transferred to fraudulent accounts and, legitimate accounts, I understand, can be set up, by hiring students, for example. But, it's just amazing that there's no cross-checks, when the account names don't match, especially when it's going into a company account. So, why there shouldn't be a red flag system in place is just beyond belief, really, at this day and age. But... I suppose.
So your situation now is, as you say, you got the product that you paid for.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, the company you were dealing with didn't get your money. The money was redirected by means of this invoice fraud. So you should be okay in theory. They're the people who are down the money.
They are, they're down. I paid for exactly I paid fair and square for what I got, where I thought I was paying it to, and it was their email that was hacked.
But they now are looking for their money.
Against me, they are. And look, it's just, you know, I just don't see how I'm at fault exactly, because the hacker was brought to me. I was paying in good faith to what I thought was the legitimate person. So I just don't feel I should be fully, you know, accountable for all this. And that, suppose, it's just to see, has it happened to other people out there, and how have they dealt with it? And, you know, because it's very distressing. And, like, obviously,
But you must have got, Anne, you must have got such a land when you got...
Oh, my God, yeah. I did. And to be honest, it's haunted me every day since.
Yeah, so you, like... and you, was it in a number of installments that this 20,000 was transferred?
Yeah. And it was literally, well, it was recurrent payments. Basically, just on the amount, you know, because you're doing online, you've only a certain amount you can do. And I mean, it's, you know, you've obviously all the account details are set up, so you know it's or you think
it's,
you know, where it's going. Yeah. So it was. And then obviously then there was a month in between. I think there was some time in between for the final instalment, which was a smaller amount. And again, it was the exact amount on the invoice. So I didn't see any question as to why, you know, why there'd be any. There was no red flags for me. No, not at all. And so it was just they were very. What would you say, professional in what they were doing. And so look, that's where I'm at, really. So it's kind of, there's two questions. There's just who's accountable, and, you know, you have the banks there, you have the companies not been insured, like, surely this day and age, you know, even for to be set up and not, you know, someone to be able to hack their accounts when they've, you know,
well-established,
you know, there's insurance places for these. So I just don't see why I'm at fault here. And I just, it's just to see what has this happened to other people and how it's been dealt with. Like, even this, as my solicitor is even scratching their head, you know.
Yeah, I suppose it raises the question, where does the liability lay? Whose responsibility is it to get this money to?
That's it, yeah.
But you're now in a position where you're basically being sued for that money, even though you have paid it to this fraudulent account already.
Yeah,
very, very difficult situation, and I'd say you're not alone. I mean, I know that this type of fraud where your invoices are redirected is a well-known type of scam.
It is a well-known. I've heard whispers, but I haven't had any concrete, you know.
Oh, look, I have a number, actually. Sorry, I have it here in front of me. Invoice fraud cost Irish businesses around €10.5 million in 2020. That's according to the Guards.
Yeah. And they are, I know they are looking into it, but they're nowhere, I'd say, near where they should be. And I know, actually, I even read an Instagram, a recent article from our neighbours in the UK, where they do cover bank customers for this type of fraud. So, you know, we're way behind here, as usual, I suppose. But and we tend to kind of come after the UK and that, but it's not good enough, really. It's just, you know, it shouldn't happen.
Yeah, your issue really is that the bank should have been more careful in terms of allowing you to transfer money into an account that didn't match, when the names didn't match.
Yeah, I think, you know, that has to be the first protocol. But I suppose, as well, as companies need to be protected as well, that, you know, when they have set up and they're looking for and they're requesting money from customers, they need to be insured and they need to, you know, prevent hackers. I mean, it wasn't my fault that someone else's, I know anyone's account can be hacked, but it's just, and I know it's gone rampant with COVID and everything, but it's just, they need to be protected as well. And, you know, customers shouldn't be at fault. You know.
Yeah. I suppose we all know a lot more about cybercrime now since that HSE hack.
That's more of it. It just seems to be, there seems to be more stories.
Yeah.
Every week.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And many thanks for that. If anybody else has any stories in that line that can give us any information or advice about who's at fault and where that might go, we would be delighted to hear from them. But I'll just go back to our. The story we spoke about at the top of the programme briefly, Noel Gately. Noel, good afternoon.
Gately, how are you? You well?
Driving home on Tuesday night?
Driving home Tuesday night, yeah, from a hurling match. Just literally just moved to Carlow on Monday, went home for a hurling match Tuesday, and coming down the motorway, the same stretch that the lads were on about there earlier, between Kilcullen and Carlow, going about 120 kilometres an hour, and just out of nowhere, baby deer out in front of me. Didn't have time to react, just literally just hit it straight on, and lost control of my car for a good 100 metres down the road. It spun down the road. Lucky enough, the roads were wet, and ended up on the grass verge on the side of the motorway. There for then for about maybe 10 minutes, facing the ditch, shaking, very, you know, shook up after it and everything. And I thought maybe the deer was gone off the road, because an awful lot of lorries and cars just sort of kept going past at their normal speed, didn't seem to be slowing down. It was only about 5 minutes later when a car pulled in. Two fellas got out, and they said they were after hitting a deer that was dead on the road. And they ran back up the road. And it was only sort of when they ran back up the road that I realised, like, how far down the road I was after going completely out of control of my car.
Yeah,
so, gosh. Yeah, it was fairly scary now.
Fairly scary is the word for it.
Yeah. I'm just very thankful that there was no barrier to my left. If there was a barrier and I'd hit a barrier, it would have been a completely different situation. If I hit the barrier at 120 kilometres an hour, I definitely wouldn't have got out of the car in the shape I did.
You definitely would not know. I'm really struck by all the near misses and how very, very close to very serious tragedy many of our callers came to in the last few days and weeks. Noel, thanks for that. I'm delighted that you live to tell the tale there. But obviously, yeah. this is an issue that we're going to hear some more about, I'm sure. But that's all. We're out of time now. Mark McGrath was on sound today. Richie Byrne was on research. Daniel Keating was the BCO. And the producer today was the series producer, Rebecca Meehan. And stand by now, Ray Darcy is back.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with Kia. For more on our 212 offers, visit your local Kia dealer or log on to kia.com.
1850-715-815 stays open until 3:15 p.m. or email joe@rte.ie.